Hi, I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, host of the Above Average Intelligence podcast here on the DSR Network. Every Monday, I speak with journalists, authors, and of course, actual former intelligence officers, spies like myself, for a look at current events from the perspective of the intelligence community. If that sounds good to you, then please consider becoming a member of the DSR Network. Members of the DSR Network gain access to exclusive content, access to the DSR Slack and Discord communities, expanded show notes for select episodes, and more. All of this for just $7 a month or $70 for a year. As a thank you for listening, I'm offering 25% off the regular membership price. Please visit thedsrnetwork.com/buy and enter code Intel. That's thedsrnetwork.com/buy and code Intel.
This is Above Average Intelligence, a production of the DSR Network. Each week, hosts Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf are joined by leading experts from the intelligence community for expert analysis on the biggest security challenges around the world.
Welcome to the podcast. I'm Mark Polymeropoulos, and this is DSR's Above Average Intelligence show. Today, I'm very happy. Actually, I'm more than happy. I'm thrilled to welcome as my guest, Mr. Pat Wenninger, a former colleague of mine, a very good friend of mine. And as you'll note, and as we'll go through today, this is one of the first times he's kind of out in public talking about not only his career, but more importantly, some of the things he's working on in the national security space. So it's a delight to have Pat on here. Pat, welcome.
Thank you, Mark. It's great to be here. We've been talking about this for the last year. You've been trying to get me on, so I eventually relented, and now I'm on. So
that's right. I was not taking no for an answer, but we are honored you're on Above Average Intelligence. I think this is the first podcast, national security podcast, you've done. I think you're going to have people lining up afterwards for your expertise. That. But we were the first, and trust me, I will give all of our competing shows a lot of ribbing. Let me just go over a quick bio. For our listeners, after retiring from the CIA in 2020, Mr. Wenninger was a founding member of Presage Security, and as of June 2023, became the CEO of Chess Solutions, a wholly owned subsidiary of Presage. Chess Solutions is a U.S. government solutions provider that has expertise in detecting and assessing manipulated media like deepfakes, as well as providing expert training and strategic consulting. And I'll kind of little hint for the listeners, we're going to talk about some deep fakes and what this means for 2024 and beyond. A little bit more about Pat. He served 29 years in the national security space, both with the CIA and the U.S. military. He retired from the Senior Intelligence Service of the Director of Operations at he served in executive level CIA headquarters assignments, overseeing clandestine operations, tradecraft, and technical operations for the DO, the Director of Operations. He is a multi-time chief of station with multiple war zone assignments. And this is something that is quite important now, and I think will be of huge interest. He oversaw and led CIA's worldwide Russia program from 2017 to 2019, a time, of course, where nothing really happened substantial in the world. I'm kidding, of course. And was critical to countering Russian threats to future U.S. government elections. Mr. Wenninger speaks Portuguese. Pretty wild that the agency taught you that, and maintains an extensive network across the USIC and many foreign governments. Again, Pat, it's a delight to have you on. This show is a lot of fun. We spend kind of, three quarters of the time talking serious stuff, a quarter of the time kind of making fun of me. Guests are allowed to do that. My love of the Vienna Inn, where I spent St. Patrick's Day yesterday.
Nice.
Which was not a great idea, considering I had to get up at 3:30 in the morning to do way too early, and Morning Joe today. But I was at Vienna Inn yesterday for St. Patrick's Day. We can talk about my love of heavy metal music, such as Metallica, and my new favorite band, which is Slipknot, which people think I'm insane for at almost 55 years old. And, of course, my love of the Boston Red Sox. So anytime you think we're kind of deviating from something, or if we're not talking about something you're comfortable with, and I will note, of course, that Pat, like all our former Intel community guests, like myself as well, we are bound by the secrecy agreement. We take this very seriously with CIA. And so, perhaps disappointing to some listeners, you're not going to learn any classified information today, but you're going to learn a hell of a lot about CIA, some great Americans like Pat, and in particular, some of the things he's worried about into the future with deepfakes and, what this 2024 election season will bring. So, Pat, let's jump into current events. Again, something that you are very familiar with, what's going on in Ukraine. So give us a sense of why you think Ukraine matters for U.S. national security. And then we'll kind of, after that, we'll dive into this kind of, you know, pretty celebrated New York Times piece that ran, what, 2 weeks ago, which talked about the CIA's role in Ukraine. But first and foremost, why does Ukraine matter?
Well, I think, you know, first of all, thanks for being here, Mark. It really is an honor and a pleasure to be here. And obviously, known you for a long time, our friendship. So it's great to be here with you. So thanks. Well, it does matter. I mean, you know, we're in this current state where there's two major adversaries for the United States, Russia and China. And right now we're ostensibly in a proxy war with Russia via Ukraine. And I think, you know, it's staggering to see the numbers, the losses that Russia has taken in the last 2 years. Obviously, we just hit the 2 year anniversary. You know, there was a recent declassified intelligence from the U.S. government saying over 315,000 KIA'd or wounded.
Stunning.
In Russia.
Stunning number. Mind-boggling.
Exactly. Yeah. Over 2,200 tanks destroyed. I mean, that is significant. So Russia has absolutely lost capability, capacity to fight over the last 2 years. And the blood and treasure of the Ukrainians have done that. So our ability to support them, should I say continue supporting them, I think will determine the future of Ukraine flat out. I mean, that's the bottom line for me. We have an opportunity to continue to degrade Russia and take them several notches down via this war. And I do think if we, you know, God forbid, support doesn't come through, history's not going to think favorably of the United States. It's going to be viewed as turning our back on our Ukrainian brothers and sisters, but also, more importantly, I think missing an opportunity to degrade this adversary that we've had for dozens of years. So I think it's a unique opportunity something the U.S. government needs to seize. And frankly, you know, the U.S. population needs to understand it a little bit better. I think there needs to be a better argument made for why it needs to be done. And, you know, we can talk about why some of the support could be fading. And obviously, I think the events in Israel and Gaza have also impacted that. Maybe it's faded a little bit because of that. But, you know, I welcome your thoughts on that. It's a really interesting topic and a huge opportunity to degrade a major adversary of ours.
Well, you know, first of all, I could not agree more. You know, this is kind of the great fight of our time. You know, so much like I spent hours and hours recently talking about Gaza in the media. But if you think about U.S. national security interests, you could actually make the argument Ukraine is more important.
Yeah.
You know, what's happening in Israel is important, but Ukraine really is because of this great power competition with Russia. I think you could provide us perhaps with an interesting perspective because you were a chief of station overseas, and I think I can say confidently without where you did serve in Europe, and so give us a perspective of Europe's perception of not only the war in Ukraine but kind of this, you know, what kind of the question, what's happened to the U.S. right now? We were so good for so long and kind of, you know, propping up the NATO alliance. We have new NATO members now, but now things are getting a little shaky. So, you know, put your hat on if you're back in Europe as a station chief dealing with, you know, a friendly foreign liaison service, but also from the perspective of the Europeans as they watch us with our Ukraine policy.
Yeah, I think there's two parts to that question. First of all, you know, and the first way I'd answer that is, and you were there, you know, in 2017 to 2019, working together, you and I, in the Europe Eurasia Mission Center. We had a front row seat to the fallout of the 2016 elections and what the Russians did to undermine and interfere in our elections. And, you know, we took it upon us. Our charter was to, you know, identify partners that viewed Russia as a compatible target. And many of those were in Europe. And you know, how do we put the plumbing in to build Russia programs together with our closest partners, particularly in Europe? And you know, the mantra that we had at the time was, you know, we could do a Russia program by ourselves pretty good. You guys could do one by yourselves pretty good. But imagine if we worked together, we could leverage the best of each other's capability. So I think, you know, we did that, and I think that's paying dividends today. particularly in the intelligence relationships across Europe. So that's the first point, that those relationships were there before 2017, and I think we amplified them and helped them via this issue of Russia to get better and build a better pipe, build better plumbing, if you will. The second part of that is, I think, you know, early on, in 2 years ago when this war started, you know, we were initially slow to come with resources, and we view Europe as our backyard, and obviously NATO as our closest partners. We were slow to come provide resources, and now we've certainly come around now, where we're providing, you know, this administration is providing a lot more lethal than we initially were. And, you know, that sense of, hey, are we really trying to win or just trying not to lose was out there. So there could have been some frustration on our European partners about, hey, we shared the information with them. And I think that's publicly known that we shared information with them to highlight the threat of Russia and what it meant vis-a-vis Ukraine. And then initially we were slow to provide resources, and then we accelerated that. And now I think because of the politics of this being an election year, we are, you know, it's in jeopardy right now, frankly, whether or not we provide resources. And I know both you and I are in violent agreement that we need to provide those resources. But Europe's kind of looking at us, right? They're looking at us to say, hey, American leadership, where are you? What are you going to do? So I think, you know, if I was a chief of station in Europe right now, it would be in a very difficult spot, because it's really hard to read the tea leaves of what's happening here in Washington.
Right.
But encouraging our European partners to continue their, you know, valuable support to the Ukraine effort. And they're kind of looking at us like, hey, we're going to give, but hey, the U.S. has got to give more, as we traditionally do. And that's a question mark, unfortunately, right now. So I think it would be really tough right now to be a COS in Europe.
Well, you know, that's of course why we're paid the big bucks, or we were the big bucks. But, you know, even to jump on a little more with that. So imagine if you're actually, and let's go, I'm going to say this is hypothetical so we don't get into trouble, but imagine if you're a case officer in theater working with the Ukrainians somewhere. Imagine how, how you have to describe American politics to your Ukrainian counterparts, whose families may have been killed, whose families may be dying, whose you know, family members may be missing. And so, you know, it can be a hell of a tough job being, you know, at the tip of the spear, kind of doing the right thing. And then sometimes kind of back in the rear, you know, our political masters are perhaps not doing the things they should. And let me just throw one other thing there. And you know, Pat's being modest, but, you know, one of the things that both, you know, both you and I did as we came over, frankly, from the counterterrorism world, and the world of kind of Near East operations to do the counter-Russia program. If you recall, and I can talk about this because this was cleared by our publication review board, that we wrote something kind of collectively, which was called a call to arms. And it was the notion that, you know, after what Russia did to us in 2016, you know, we have to treat every day like it was September 12th. Let's go back to that September 11th mindset. Now, we don't have a, you know, find, fix, finish option with the Russians, unfortunately, I would add, that's probably getting it too extreme. But, you know, it was really the idea of kind of taking it back to them. And I will say that, just, you know, I'll embarrass you a little bit, Pat, but you led the way, you led the charge globally, and Americans owe you some gratitude for that. As one of our old bosses say, you certainly paid the rent. But let me switch to something, the New York Times article, which caused, you know, quite the stir in national security circles. It was written by Adam Nentus, who's a great reporter. He was on the show here. He kind of detailed, you know, much of the history of CIA's involvement with Ukraine. Talk a little bit about the article, and I think it would be helpful for you as an intelligence veteran to note, and maybe I'm putting words in your mouth now, why you think it's okay. Why is it important for kind of the world? In an unclassified sense, but to know what the CIA has accomplished there in doing exactly what you called in putting in the plumbing.
Yeah, it's a great question, and I got to be a little bit mindful here. But I thought the article was really well written, really well investigated, had some fantastic facts. You know, as you know, being retired now for 3 years and part of the, you know, Joe Public, just like everybody else, it was really interesting for me to read. Obviously, we had some unique insight on what Adam was relaying in that article. But I think, you know, I'll go back to what I kind of mentioned earlier. It really highlighted something that the agency is really traditionally good at, and that is building capacity and capability in our liaison partners. And at the end of the day, that's what that article was about. And to me, that was one of the, you know, looking where we're at right now with Ukraine and Russia. I mean, the folks that were involved in that program should be really proud that we've put the Ukrainians in a position to be successful, not only in the intelligence channel, but obviously with providing military capability. And frankly, they've been very successful. As we talked about, the numbers kind of, you know, reflect that and the massive losses that the Russians have had. So having a role in that and helping the Ukrainians navigate that threat, understand the timing of the threat, something that our analytical brothers and sisters were able to provide, is really helpful. You know, now the challenge is going to be is continuing that fight, as we talked about. You know, again, like we talked about, the good news is we don't have any currency or 3 years currency for both of us. So, you know, we don't know any secrets in the last 3 years, but I suspect that that intelligence channel is even more robust now than it was before. And, you know, this is a time where we need it. And you know, it's interesting for me, as you well know, in our liaison relationships that we have around the world. And again, this is one of the things that I think we do best as an organization, as CIA, where sometimes a strategic relationship is up between our two countries and sometimes it goes down and there's difficult times, like right now, when, you know, military support is being questioned here politically, but that impacts our strategic relationship. But that intelligence channel is right, consistent always through that. And that's something, again, that we should all be proud of. And many Americans may not realize that there's, that kind of silence aspect of what we do, what the agency does, as far as building those relationships, and having very strong personal relationships that translate into professional relationships. And again, it's all about building that capacity and capability in our partners. And I think this was the finest example of that I can remember in recent time. And I think Adam did a great job of outlining that, not without controversy, not without sacrifice, but at the end of the day, it was extremely successful. And you can point to the numbers right now on the ground.
I agree with you. And I would argue that, you know, first of all, this goes against the grain. You know, traditionally, you know, in the intelligence business, you know, when you and I were kind of growing up, you know, coming out of the womb into CIA, no one thought that articles like this were a good idea. No one thought, and frankly, a podcast like this was a good idea. But 2024 is different. And you know, in a way that, you know, where you know, certainly when I joined the agency, probably, you know, if you look at intelligence products, you know, or trying to assess the situation, it was 80% kind of clandestine reporting, signals intelligence, 20% open source. It's flipped now.
Yeah.
Where the open source world is so massive. So, you know, CIA telling a story.
Exactly.
You know, and doing it in the right way, without kind of putting any sources and methods at risk. But the American people have to understand the value of the intelligence community and the value of CIA, or we're going to be out of business. And so I'm okay with directors who are in public. I'm okay with stories like this as long as it does no harm.
Right.
And I'll tell you that, you know, when Adam came on the show, you know, he was glowing in his praise of what CIA accomplished. And you know, ultimately he said, look, the American people need to know this. And I think that's correct. And I just want to highlight one thing in terms of building relationships, what you said. I mean, that is absolutely critical. You know, as you know, as a case officer, you know, we have two duties. One is to spot, assess, develop, recruit, and handle an agent, an asset, you know, a foreigner who's providing us, you know, a secret information. And you do that protecting the asset's life. And hopefully they're kind of giving us some golden nuggets. But the other part of our job is what we call liaison. And that's the idea of working with foreign intelligence services. And you can make an argument. And I think our counter-Russia program and the program in Ukraine really supports this, is that at times it's just as important as kind of unilateral operations. And because guess what happened when the Russians invaded Ukraine? You know, President Zelensky didn't have to call Langley, you know, a 703 number in Northern Virginia. You know, he probably went, you know, and I'll, you know, he called the U.S. Embassy, or he called, you know, they called people who had been there on the ground since 2014.
Right.
And the other part of this too is in conflicts like this, in areas like this, sometimes we do have kind of continuity in officers, so there's familiarity. So absolutely, personal relationships are absolutely everything. And you know, the last piece on Ukraine, and perhaps you'd agree with me, you know, you and I, our careers, you know, we did so much together in kind of different arenas. I think we were both the same base chief in different times. We both were the same deputy station chief in the Middle East in different times. But what I found with Ukraine is, you know, unlike kind of this fuzziness in the 20 years of Iraq and Afghanistan, where there was lots of righteous things we did, and some maybe we stayed too long in some other places and expanded the things the U.S. government should or shouldn't have done. But Ukraine is this David versus Goliath story. Like, it makes you feel good. And you know, to me, and there's nothing in life that's black or white, except kind of in Ukraine, where I really think it is the good guys versus the bad guys. That's, to me, that was the appeal. Any thoughts on that?
And I think, you know, absolutely. I think the David and Goliath analogy is perfect. But, you know, there's also another side of that, is that the attrition aspect of it is that if you look at the population of Russia, I think it's 150 million.
Right.
Ukraine is around 45 million. So, you know, it goes back to why we need to fund and support our Ukrainian brothers and sisters that are in this fight, because the longer this goes on, you can see Russia just has more bodies they can throw at this than the Ukrainians do. So attrition is a thing that we need to think about. But absolutely, I mean, it's fantastic, and it really is a great story on how the IC and the military have come behind with the political support to really fund and resource Ukraine to get them to this point. Now the challenge is going to be continuing going forward. Yep.
Let's hope that goes forward. And again, just for kind of the listeners out there, Pat is someone who is integral to these efforts, and so I certainly am appreciative of what you have done. Let's talk a little bit about your retirement gig now. And you know, we've spoken offline about this. I think, you know, in some ways, people have an act two in life. Or maybe this is your act three. I know you were in the military before, so this is your act three. But in some cases, you know, some of the things you might be doing right now are certainly going to be just as important. Let's talk about artificial intelligence. The idea of what generative, I can't ever get this right, artificial intelligence means. And you know, we would direct readers to the National Security Organ, the Cipher Brief, where you wrote an article recently, which was entitled "Elections Are Prime for Waves of Misinformation." Talk to us about your worries about this, what you're doing, why this matters in 2024, and if you can kind of say generative AI over and over again. Yeah. I certainly can't, but you're probably better suited than that.
Nothing. Look,
I'm just a kind of you know, middle class Greek kid from New Jersey, so. Yeah. Go ahead.
And I'm a middle-class kid from Fayetteville, North Carolina that went to state. So I think we're in the same boat. Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, first of all, I think our understanding of the threat of misinformation, like I said, really came from having a front row seat of the fallout of the 2016 elections when we were working together back in the agency. So seeing that firsthand and working actively while we were in the building to ensure that the Russians are not able to do that again. Like, we need to get out on our front foot. We can't let them manipulate our national elections again. Was really one of the main challenges that we were working against. So now, being in the private sector, you know, our company is building solutions that can detect and assess manipulated media, i.e. deep fakes. It's, you know, that sense of, you know, bringing social value and having impact in the national security area hasn't changed. We just happen to be private citizens now. So that's kind of the impetus behind us, our company, getting involved in this issue. And as far as what is generative AI, you know, it really has come to bear in the last year. But it's really focused on computer created, manipulated content, basically. So being able to create, you know, voices or your likeness to the point where it's real and people believe it's real. So it's much more difficult to separate truth from fiction because of generative AI. That's basically what it does. And it accelerates, you know, potential nefarious actors' ability to do that, to create content that looks real. And it also makes it more difficult to detect. So it is a huge challenge for us. You know, in the World Economic Forum recently put out an article basically saying that, you know, the threat of misinformation and disinformation from generative AI is the biggest threat over the next 2 years. And even in the annual threat assessment that just came out, you know, and the DNI and the director were on the Hill talking about it. As far as disruptive technology, you know, one of the major players was generative AI and the threat posed from that, from our adversaries. And, you know, it specifically commented on Russia using this to potentially, you know, undermine elections, undermine stability of governments. So it's certainly something that's out there that we need to be thinking about. Not only the government needs to be thinking about, in my view, I think the private sector and civil societies need to be thinking about it also and how we can, you know, help and assist.
So without getting political, you don't have to name candidates. Give us a scenario. Give us an example of how, let's say Russia, you know, was to do something. Well, of course they are already. But let's say Russia, in the Russian playbook, was going to kind of undertake some kind of, you know, attack using generative AI. What's a scenario in which they would do this? Also understanding that, you know, sometimes they, you know, their active measures, their covert action goals are just to sow chaos.
Correct.
So give us an idea. Give us an example of what we could see. Don't talk about candidate names. No. It doesn't matter. X, you know, there's candidate X, candidate Y. Someone wins, someone loses. What does Russia do to screw with our system?
Yeah. First of all, I think there's two parts. It's a great question. There's two parts of it. As you point out, I mean, the Russian malign influence active measures programs, they're trying to sow discord, influence our political process, erode confidence in our democratic institutions. And you can say that they did that in 2016, and that's a whole nother conversation, and that is carried on to today. I mean, you could make the argument that's why one of the reasons why our politics are so polarized, because of what happened in 2016 and how that's continued today. But, you know, there's my concern is not only the ability to quickly generate deepfake videos, audios, images in Texas leading up to the election, but also, and I want to talk about that for a second, because there's been a couple of warning shots that we've seen. You know, in January for the New Hampshire primary, there was an AI-generated robocall of the president telling voters not to vote, wait till November to vote. That is voter manipulation. That is, and you know, and that was socially engineered using generative AI. In October, the Slovakia elections, there was a pro-NATO candidate and an anti-NATO candidate. The pro-NATO candidate, there was a 2-day moratorium just prior to the election where they could do no campaign ads or no information go out. And there was a leaked call of the pro-NATO candidate talking to a journalist about quote unquote rigging the elections. That was AI generated, an audio deep fake that was released. He ended up losing the election. Can you say that was because of that? I don't know, but that is an example of potential voter manipulation, the types of things that we need to be concerned about. Those are examples of leading up to the election. And oh, by the way, you know, just real quick, just to put this into context, you know, you hear a lot of people talk about this 2024 is the year of the elections, that over half the population around the world is going to be voting. You have elections in the US. You know, we just had an election yesterday in Russia. Which was, yeah, you know, we could say what we want afterwards.
If you call it that.
If you call it that, exactly. You know, India, Pakistan, Mexico. So it's kind of the perfect storm where you now have all these platforms, right, of elections, of platforms for nefarious actors to use generative AI. And the world's very polarized right now, by the way. You know, there's hostilities around the world. There's geopolitical strife. You name it. So it's almost like the perfect storm. So you have all these platforms of these elections, you have a lot of global issues that people are unhappy about, polarization. And then now you have this fancy new technology where, it's the democratization of it, really, where it's anybody can use it. It used to be, we were worried about a state actor. Now anybody can use it. So now getting back to your point, to kind of put that into context, what scenario, what I'm concerned about is not only voter manipulation leading up to the election, But what happens on between election day and inauguration day? What if one candidate, you know, loses by 1% and the election is in question? And then suddenly the Russians or another adversary sees that and says, let me pick the losing candidate and amplify or generate deepfake content to misinform and maybe, hey, let's storm the Capitol. Let's go protest at the Capitol to show our frustration with this election cycle. You know, that scares me what's going to happen because it's going to be contentious this election, I imagine, no matter who wins. So what happens, you know, again, that's going to be fertile ground for a wave of misinformation, not only leading up to the election, but I think between election day, after election day and inauguration day is going to be also very dangerous for us.
I think you're 100% correct. I mean, this is quite terrifying to me because, you know, while we spend a lot of time talking about the responsibility of Americans and the American political parties, in some sense, this then gets taken out of our hands, and you have our adversaries, you know, stirring the pot, manipulating an already polarized society. And so the next logical question, and I assume this is what your company is doing, is how do we defend against this? Yeah. So we've identified a very serious vulnerability to the United States, to our democratic system. How do we defend against this in particular? Or I guess the next question would be, do we need almost kind of a war room mentality?
Yeah.
Are so many deep fakes going to be coming in that we're overwhelmed? So what's the defense?
Yeah.
You know, how do we counter this?
First of all, I think it's a great question. And one thing that has to be factored in there is, you know, our freedoms, our freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and balancing that against, you know, security. That is a challenge for our government to address. And before I answer your question, the second part that also makes is a challenge is constitutionally, you know, the federal government, you know, where does the federal government responsibility start and stop? Because, as you know, states are responsible for our presidential elections.
I don't think a lot of people know that. Say right. That again. Tell us why this is so important.
Well, I mean, where does the responsibility for the federal government start and stop when it comes to misinformation? Because they don't want to overstep potentially, because the responsibility for our presidential election is at the state level, right?
Right.
And every state has different laws.
That's
so there is, in my view, and this is, you know, the intelligence officer in me, the DNA in us, is that I always believe the federal government has a responsibility for indications and warnings. The problem with that nowadays is that the federal government will be viewed as speaking for the current administration, which could be viewed as biased. Compounding that is, I don't think the state governments have the resources to detect and assess manipulated media in a very efficient time, even if they did, right? So that is that is a challenge right now. So going back to your first question, I wanted to kind of put that in context and then say, okay, what do we do about it? And I think there's four areas really to focus on. And none of these are easy, by the way, right? Which goes back to your point, it's a little bit scary. But this is just my own personal opinion, kind of being in this space for a little bit and then having some context from being a former intelligence officer. I think there's four parts. And I think the federal government has a responsibility in all of these. And one of it is, you know, prevention. You know, how do you create technologies, fund innovation that prevent misinformation from happening? And, you know, this is a challenge because the generative AI genie is out of the bottle, if you will. You can't put it back in. You can't stymie that innovation now. In fact, you know, if you talk, the experts are like, hey, we're on the front end of what generative AI looks like today and 4 years from now is going to be very different, right? Which is even scarier. So it's out of the bottle. So now how do you build technologies to prevent misinformation from happening using generative AI? One example is watermarking. In other words, have transparency. So if there's information out there, the public knows they're looking at something that is not real, right? That's the first thing. The second thing I think is detection. And that's kind of the space we're in. But you know, detection is also a challenge too, because it's so much data, right? And it's a lot easier to create than to detect First of all, let's say that right off the bat. Right. Like I said, the democratization of this technology, it's much easier to create than to detect. And as you detect, the scalability is critical. Can you detect at scale? Because typically when you detect at scale, your accuracy goes down. So those are challenges, but there are technological solutions that are being worked on in that space. And it's not just about, is it real or fake? It's the explainability behind it. And then at some point, what's the attribution? That's critical too, right? As intelligence officers, that's always something we're interested in. I think the third part is legislation. Again, not easy, because the technology is moving so fast. How can the US government legislate and have anticipatory legislation that's going to factor in the evolution of the technology? You know, our Congress isn't built that way to do that, frankly. The EU Act is they're taking a good first step on it. We see some states bringing in legislation to address deepfakes, particularly on the porn side. You know, unfortunately, there's been, you know, some instances where kids, again, the democratization of the technology, are making, you know, fake deep porns of their of females in high school. But just a few weeks ago, you know, another good first step I saw at least was Georgia started criminalizing the use of deepfakes in campaigns 90 days prior to an election. I thought that was a good first step. You know, you got to give them credit. But again, that's at the state level. And that's focused on campaigns, not necessarily the external threat from external actors. But it's a good first step. It's something that needs to be done, in my view. So it's a challenge, though, the legislation piece. And then I think the fourth part is the education piece. Like, how do you educate people about misinformation? You know, there's this thing called confirmation bias, where we believe what we tend to believe. So your deep fake doesn't have to be 100%. Even though it can be, it can be 70 or 80%. If it aligns with what you are thinking already, you will believe it, right? That's that confirmation bias that I was talking about. So the good news on the education piece, there's some organizations that are out there. There's one in particular that comes to mind, thefuture.us. It's led by a guy by the name of Miles Taylor. He's a former national security professional and expert. They're doing some really good things. Like they're actively trying to focus on election integrity from outside of government. They're bringing in think tanks. They're bringing in nonprofits. They're bringing in tech companies to try to build, focus on election integrity and build that potential war room that identifies and helps, you know, the state level when there's questions about misinformation. Because how quickly, and this is my words, someone who is someone says that, you know, a video or an audio is fake is going to be critical. Because if it goes viral, again, you can't put the genie back in the bottle. What was the impact of that? So
you lose control. Well, I think you're 100% right. Again, your company is a Chess Solutions. I wish you the best in this. It's almost a Herculean task, but it's one that's critical. And again, if I never thought in the, you know, I don't know, 10, 15 years ago, we'd be talking about some of the greatest national security challenges being generative AI. See, I still can't say that.
Right. See, we're two CT warriors, and now we're talking about this stuff. It's kind of crazy, isn't it?
All right. Well, look, this is the point in the podcast where we have to say goodbye to our guests who are not yet subscribers. If you want to listen to the rest of the pod and to all of our other shows in full, just go to the dsrnetwork.com and click on membership. It is $7 a month, and it brings you a lot of great bonus content. So if you're not a subscriber, we hope you will be soon. And if you are one, stand by. We will be back in one moment. And we have some great bonus content here as Pat and I will be talking about something near and dear to our heart, which is the future of the CIA Special Operations Forces relationship.
Thank you for listening to Above Average Intelligence, hosted every week by Mark Polymeropoulos and David Rothkopf. Above Average Intelligence is a production of the DSR Network and was produced by Riley Fessler.